This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. We will head into the weekend with Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, who makes an urgent call on some huge policy issues from infrastructure to Haiti. But first, it is Friday, so it is our week in review, and it has been a week. The challenge is New England exceptionalism, highway and courtroom standoffs with an extremist group who are challenging the authority of our legal system.
I'm going to ask you not to interrupt me again.
And our collective belief that extremism is something that happens elsewhere. Those arrested not only reject our sovereignty, but call our legal system unfair. Here's a proclaimed member of the Rise of the Moors speaking to reporters outside the courthouse.
A lot of these states are violating the various copper-toned peoples of the Americas' rights constantly on a daily basis, and not just us, everybody.
The challenge in return, rejecting extremist claims while continuing to improve justice in our systems. Here's retired federal judge Nancy Gertner.
If people, as a general matter, say the criminal legal system is unfair and therefore I'm not bound by it, whatever the issues with the criminal legal system, and there are many, if that would be sufficient to walk away from a crime, then there would be anarchy.
Plus, a Trump-era Republican asks Massachusetts to make him governor, and the Delta variant puts New England's vaccination success to the test. So let's talk about all of this. Joining us now for analysis, Renee Graham, a Boston Globe columnist and a WBUR contributor, and Tom Nichols, a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and a contributing writer at The Atlantic. Renee, Tom, welcome back.
Always good to be here.
So we are going to start with the Route 128 standoff, and listeners, join the conversation. Were you surprised to find extremism at our door in this way? Are you satisfied with the way our institutions have responded? What do you think should happen next? And are you worried about a potential pattern here? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To join the conversation. Now, Renee and Tom, I want to point out on the show earlier this week, we said that we've learned from experts to use great care in giving media attention to extremist groups, especially if we think that's what they want. Mindful of that, but we're seeing real challenges to our institutions. So I'd like to focus us on how our institutions have responded this week, if and how you're processing this incident, and how you think about it alongside two other horrible extremist attacks recently, the stabbing of a rabbi in Brighton and the killing of two black residents in Winthrop. So that's kind of our framing here. Let me start by just saying, Renee, are you happy with how law enforcement responded on Route 128 over the weekend?
I mean, I think it's fair to say I was surprised. I did not have confidence that it was going to end peacefully. And even though the leader of the Rise of the Moors said that they wanted a peaceful resolution, you know, given how heavily armed they were, I wasn't really sure that that was going to be the case. So, you know, it was good to see law enforcement respond with restraint. It is good to see that law enforcement is capable of responding with restraint, because I think it would have been horrific if you know, guns had started firing. So, yeah, I mean, up to that point, yeah, I was absolutely satisfied with how things were resolved.
Tom, do you agree?
Yeah, I think the whole incident spoke pretty well of the Massachusetts State Police and the court system, which, you know, didn't let this turn into a circus and tried to just process this as kind of a weird incident that, you know, it happened and arrests were made. And now things kind of, you know, the wheels of justice just go on. So I think responding to this with calm and measure was exactly what you'd hope for from your public institutions.
So I want to kind of parse this out a little bit. Renee, I think I'll turn to you first. So we are in a time of reckoning over law enforcement in the black community. These were black men openly carrying unlicensed firearms in Massachusetts. We had a standoff with law enforcement. We had, as you noted, a peaceful resolution. We also had heavy criminal charges levied. So we know that race is at play for those who were arrested. Moorish identity is a central tenet to them. Do you believe race has been at play in how our institutions have handled this unfolding incident this week?
You know, I do think there's a kind of, I guess, a sort of curiosity factor. I think initially when the reports came in last Saturday morning, everyone, I think, assumed it was going to be a white extremist group. the fact that it was a Black extremist group, I think, heightened tensions for a lot of people. You know, who are they? What did they want? They certainly weren't known to many people. I mean, imagining that their Google searches went up 1,000% last Saturday because no one had heard of this group out of Rhode Island. But having said that, and I will admit that the fact that they were Black is why I was wary of what the outcome would be. You know, it did have a peaceful resolution. I feel the need to sort of constantly stress that. And it does say something about extremism, and that it isn't, you know, one group, you know, that people have different motives, people have different agendas, and they do come out. It was, again, as good an outcome as they could possibly have had. We've seen what's happened in court. You know, I don't think this group left Rhode Island in the wee hours of the morning with the goal of getting arrested. But I think now that they have our attention, they're going to use it to raise their profile and get across this message of Black self-determination and empowerment. And also the fact, though, that they are not beholden to American laws. So I think, you know, it's worth watching, but carefully. You know, you as you said, you don't want to give these groups more attention than necessary.
So I want to stay with that. And Tom, I'll turn to you. So there is a legitimate critique over how our legal system treats Black people. And during the week this week, as this moved into the courts, we began to see that back and forth. As Renee also points out, you know, we don't want to give credence to extremism. And I will say that we know no legitimacy to the claim that these men are foreign nationals covered by a centuries-old treaty with Morocco that places them outside Massachusetts in U.S. law. I guess my question is, do we have to refuse to let the former consideration, that of the history of our criminal justice system and Black Americans, into this discussion in order to avoid legitimizing the extremism here? Or can we have both conversations at the same time? I know that's a complex question.
Let me try and make it simple and say, no, we don't need to keep kludging together these two issues in this particular case. This is a strange group. I mean, this is not about race. This is about a bunch of guys. And I think, you know, the real conversation that would be more interesting to me is, why is America constantly generating groups of young men who feel the need to do this kind of performative behavior with guns and bizarre assertions of individual sovereignty and these kind of narcissistic cosplaying adventures out, you know, in the world. But, you know, when you're dealing with a bunch of guys who say, listen, we're governed by a 1787 treaty with Morocco. No, you are not required to take the very serious issue of race and policing in America and somehow you know, take a mallet and ram that square peg into the round hole of this particular incident. I think it's okay to simply say, look, it's a very strange, very small group, you know, from, I'm sorry to say, Rhode Island. And to just leave it at that. I mean, we don't need to make a bigger thing out of it because I don't think there's much more there to it, except for, and I will just emphasize this again, except for the proliferation, I would say over the past 40 years, of groups of young men, in this case Black, although usually white, who are engaging in this kind of performative acting out, which I think is a relatively, if you can think of 40 years as new, is a relatively new phenomenon.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join this conversation. I'm going to take a call here. We've got Nawal in Shrewsbury. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is a very interesting topic. My point is that, you know, we think extremism is always going to be born overseas and, you know, these radical groups that we've always heard about traditionally in the news and everywhere else. But here's perfect proof that, you know, it can happen anywhere. I feel just groups of people who feel marginalized or feel that they aren't heard or they have nothing better to do, they sort of form these kind of very intense kind of thoughts in their mind, and they come together and they do this thing. So it can really happen anyways. That's just my point. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. And I'm going to add a cut here to this, Renee, and then turn back to you. We spoke with Joan Donovan earlier this week, research director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard. We're talking about the sort of the hybrid nature of this group and how sort of new tracks or new lines of extremism emerge. And she said there might be something digital behind what we're seeing. Here we go.
One of the pathways to radicalization usually begins with, I met someone. But increasingly, the way in which people are becoming turned on to new ideologies, especially fringe ones, are through a process of self-discovery and self-education. One of the things we try to do is study, well, how did they come together? And is that a consequence of the way in which the internet networks these ideas?
So you got Tom talking about a relatively, quote-unquote, short 40-year history. You've got Nawal saying this can happen anywhere. You've got Joan Donovan saying people can begin to radicalize sort of networked through the internet. I'm mindful that we're 6-month anniversary this week of the insurrection at the Capitol. Do you think we're in a new era here in the area, in the Commonwealth, in New England?
I don't. I mean, I think it's odd, this idea of this New England exceptionalism. You know, I think what people have to understand, and you will hear this after every sort of violent incident, is that, well, you know, hate has no home here, and that sort of thing doesn't happen here. And I almost think that's, it's not just naive, it's almost a dangerous viewpoint. You're ignoring the obvious. You're ignoring that hate crimes are up nationwide and have been for the last half decade. You know, people have to realize that the things that they thought happened in other communities happen in their own communities. And they're happening in a different way because there is this kind of self-radicalization, you know, that you can sit in your house and you can just read this on the internet and read things on social media and suddenly start to form these ideas. Having said that, you know, we didn't always need the internet for radicalization. You know, you're talking about the country that produced the red shirts and the Klan, and a country that still does not have a federal anti-lynching law. So, it's not that big a leap when you think of the things that this country sort of shunts aside and doesn't pay attention to having someone who decides that I don't like this group for some reason, or I don't like that person because they're this race or religion or sexual orientation or gender identity, and acting on it. So I think all the internet has done is made the process a little easier, but it's all part of a violent thread that really runs through this country in its history.
I want to invite listeners, Tom, give me just 1 second, you to build on that, listeners. 1-800-423-8255. Do we have a history of a hate problem here in New England? Are we in a moment of hate now? Do you feel like there's something new going on or something age old? 800-423-8255. Tom, go ahead.
Well, I'm going to take some exception here and maybe make a small defense of New England exceptionalism. The national trend that's been going on is that we have become, as a society, more narcissistic and more lonely. That is just documented. We are more isolated. We are not as social and as communal as we once were. And so people are looking for tribal identifications of some kind, whether it's the Q cult, whether it's this, you know, strange bunch of guys who think they're, you know, descendants of Morocco, whatever it is. So that is the national and growing, and I would say even international problem. I'll take issue with your caller who says, well, you know, violent extremism can happen anywhere, but it doesn't. And you know, that's something else we know. And this brings me to the point about New England, because it seems that isolation and social culture, the political culture of an area, have a lot to do with this. I mean, there's a reason, yes, New England has hate groups. You know, there are guys hiding in the hills. There are bad people everywhere. But there's a reason that less populated states, places out west, in the mountains, where these groups tend to find more of a foothold for a lot of reasons, including the isolation and a dominant culture, for example, that doesn't look askance at guys walking around with guns or expressing, you know, racist beliefs or anti-government things. I mean, culture does matter, and culture in New England, you know, or California or New York or Georgia or Wyoming, I mean, culture makes a difference in all of this. So to simply kind of blanket this and say, well, there's crazy extremists everywhere and it's you know, an evenly spread out problem, I think is empirically just wrong.
So I think this is an interesting conversation about the moment and about patterns. Two things come to mind in listening to the two of you. First, as Catherine Clark and Joan Donovan, Assistant House Speaker Catherine Clark and Joan Donovan both pointed out this week. They tied the events of the last couple of weeks back to January 6th and the fact that we in New England had participants in an attempted insurrection there that was increasingly, it's clear, coordinated by white supremacist and extremist groups. We also at the beginning of the week, we were a little reticent to lean hard on a sense of pattern between this encounter, the stabbing of a rabbi in Brighton, the slaying of two black residents in Winthrop. But as the week has progressed, Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins has made it clear this week that at least she believes extreme ideology was at play in those as well. And so whether we think it's new or we think we're paying attention to it in some different way, it does seem, Renee, that we are seeing a spate of violent actions here that are going to require us to turn our attention there in a different way.
Well, I think one of the things that we're seeing that is different is because you had two people murdered in Winthrop because they were black. You had a rabbi attacked in Brighton because he's Jewish. You have those sort of instances, but we also know that, you know, the Holocaust Memorial downtown was vandalized. We know these things are happening. They do escalate. You know, it can start from a word yelled from a passing car. It can be a word on a wall. It could be something that gets vandalized, but it always escalates to something else. You know, it might just be at this moment that, you know, you had the Winthrop incident, and you had what happened in Brighton happened in close proximity. But, you know, I sort of hold on to the idea that, you know, we're talking about extremism, but we're talking about hate crimes. And hate crimes are up everywhere, and they have been. It's been documented locally. It's been documented federally. You know, it's not that surprising that these things happen. In both the cases in Winthrop and Brighton, there's evidence of anti-Semitic writing and racist writing. These things don't happen in a vacuum. I mean, I just think that the idea that somehow, you know, we're not Idaho or Montana is fine, but New England has always had its problems. And I think it very much becomes what perspective you have, where you sit when these things are happening and who's being impacted.
I want to play a little sound here. WBUR spoke with Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins earlier this week after her office released alleged writings by the killer in Winthrop. He wrote that, quote unquote, racism is healthy and natural. Using racist language, he also wrote that white people are apex predators, quote unquote. Here's Rollins.
It's chilling. This man was hiding in plain sight for all intents and purposes, appeared however we would define, and, you know, I'm making air quotes now, normal, seemed pleasant, et cetera. But below the surface, all of this was boiling.
So, Tom, it is chilling. We are in a chilling moment.
We are. And I think one of the things, and this gets back to the issue of the internet, one of the things that is creating a more evenly distributed threat of extremism is the internet. That, you know, people who are people who have these kinds of anger, this kind of anger and resentment, they go looking, they go shopping for ideologies on the internet in a way that they couldn't have 25 or 30 years ago. And I take Renee's point, but we're not, it's not Idaho. Massachusetts and Idaho are different. And to say that we have extremists, I mean, while we were talking, I was thinking of John Salvey, a case really well known to Bostonians. You know, the guy walks in and kills a bunch of people at Planned Parenthood. And that's now, you know, decades ago. But to say that we have them and to somehow say, well, that all of the places in America are equivalent breeding grounds for extremism. Again, I think the empirical basis for that just isn't there. And so while we're thinking about how do these things happen, I think it's also useful to ask questions like, how is it that some environments are less welcoming or less likely to breed these outcomes than others? But I think the really scary thing, and I come back to this over and over, is these aimless, violent young men spread out through the country who find reasons to kill, who find rationalizations to kill by going on the internet and living their lives virtually. This narcissistic, lonely kind of radicalized loser has been a growing type that has become a threat throughout Western society, not just in the United States, but in Canada and in Europe, particularly, for decades now. And that's something that gets submerged into race when we should be talking about a lot of other things as well.
So I want to take us out of this part of the conversation on a couple of calls. We've got Helena, I'm sorry, on the line in Arlington.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Well, I agree with just about everything that I've heard while I've been in and out of this conversation. The other thing that we need to remember is the appalling state of public education, particularly in our inner cities. The kind of historical nonsense that this particular group believes would be impossible if they'd had a decent education in basic history.
Thanks, Helena, I'll take that back from you. Although I'm not sure that the facts bear out that one can subscribe to conspiracy theories only if one has not had a solid education.
Yeah.
I think it's worth noting that.
Can I just make a comment to your caller? Education really is not the issue. This is kind of a default thing that people believe, that if only you had more education, you wouldn't believe these things. And the two things I'll point out very quickly is people who believe in conspiracy theories are actually reasonably bright because they are difficult to follow. And the other is that a lot of the people that you saw, for example, on January 6th and the insurrectionists, they were products of the so-called golden age of public education, people that are closer to my age in their 50s and 60s. So this notion that if only we had better education, these people wouldn't believe this stuff. It's something everybody believes, but it's just not true.
All right. I want to grab one more call and then we do have to go to break. Jason from Natick. Jason, go ahead. Okay, I think we must have lost Jason, so I'm going to come back here. Renee, last word to you before we go to break.
I find myself very much reminded of something that a friend said to me in college. He had grown up in Louisiana and never spent any time in the North until he went to college in Syracuse, New York. And he said to me one time that he really preferred Southern racism to Northern racism. And I thought, why? And he said, because in the South, I know exactly who my enemy is.
Still with us, The Atlantic's Tom Nichols and The Boston Globe's Renee Graham and you. Now we're going to talk politics and pandemic questions. Can a right-leaning Republican other than Governor Baker win in Massachusetts? And what are your concerns about the Delta variant? Is it changing your personal pandemic equation? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To join the conversation, Tom Nichols, what do you make of Jeff Deal's entrance into the governor's race here in the Commonwealth?
Well, I had to laugh because in my misspent youth, when I worked in the State House, I was a registered Republican working for a Democrat who was then the chairman of Commerce and Labor. And, you know, the idea that you could have this like vibrant Republican competition about which Republican is going to run Massachusetts, that's the kind of thing that over drinks at the Golden Dome, Republican staffers would fantasize about, but isn't really true. I mean, Charlie Baker is kind of a unicorn. He is pretty unique. And the idea that some kind of standard issue Republican could just take over that slot because there's some idea that Republicans can win in Massachusetts, I think is probably pretty unrealistic. And it goes back actually to the conversation we had earlier about, you know, is Massachusetts or is New England different? New England Republicans are different. And Charlie Baker is one of the most different of the New England Republicans.
So Renee, Jeff Deal is running critiquing Charlie Baker as a manager. I would argue maybe all of the current gubernatorial candidates are critiquing Charlie Baker as a manager. On our air, he advocated to end enhanced unemployment, wants a different use of tax surplus, talks about small business. These are bread and butter issues. I want to just have you hear a little bit about him on unemployment expansion.
I think right now is the time to do that. We've got more jobs than I think people that are looking for work at this point. So certainly the time, I think, to move people from the roles back into the workforce. I think it's going to make for, obviously, less demand on the unemployment fund. It's going to also, obviously, give people, I think, a better sense of satisfaction going back to work. And we can collect tax revenue off of the work that they're doing. So there's multiple benefits to getting everybody back to work.
And I'm sorry, that was a sloppy throw. I meant ending, expanded or extended unemployment. So can he, Renee, as somebody who's been solely tied, so tied to Donald Trump, 2016 campaign manager here in their campaign chair, excuse me, here in the Commonwealth, have a substantive policy conversation, or is there just too much Trump in the air for him?
I think there is just too much Trump in the air. you know, I don't see how Jeff Diehl campaigns without having to answer the question on where he stands on the big lie. And he is an ardent Trump supporter. He needs to answer where he stands on voting rights. Even though those issues aren't hitting Massachusetts, you don't have to be in Massachusetts to be concerned about what's happening with voter suppression in many other states. So in my mind, at least, Donald Trump is an albatross for Jeff Diehl. But he's not going to disconnect from him because he feels in some kind of way there will be enough people in this state that, you know, that Trump and Trumpism will appeal to that he could somehow beat Charlie Baker if Charlie Baker runs again. I agree with Tom. I simply don't see another Republican beating Charlie Baker, not in this state. And I'm no Charlie Baker fan, but I simply don't see that happening. And if it happens, it's not going to be Jeff Diehl.
Do you, listeners, 1-800-423-8255 to join this conversation. Renee, I'm going to stay with you for a second because I asked Diehl straight up, is Joe Biden the democratically elected president of the United States? And he said yes. And then I said, so is there a concern with having a national party chair on the Republican side, or a national party head, excuse me, in Donald Trump, who maintains that it was a corrupt election and that Joe Biden isn't the democratically elected president? And there his answer was, well, lots of people said Trump wasn't either in 2016. So on the one hand, you do have him answering about the big lie, and on the other, you have this hedging. What would it take for you to feel that Diehl had addressed the big lie question head on?
I think he needs to say not just that Joe Biden won, but that there was no voter fraud. And if there was no voter fraud, then there is no reason for all these voter suppression bills popping up around the country, and that this is all being bred by Donald Trump. There's really no other way around that. I think it's great that he acknowledges that that President Joe Biden is the president, okay? But he needs to go further than that, and he has to disavow what Donald Trump is saying. But if he wants Trump's support, he's never going to do that. So he's going to try to have it both ways, which frankly is kind of cheap in my mind. You know, you don't get to say, well, he's the president, but no, there's no but. That's where it ends. And you have to simply disavow what Donald Trump has been espousing now for the last 8 months.
And I do want to say, and we played this at the top of the show, when I asked him if he would support Trump again, he didn't give a direct answer. He said, you know, I want to see if he's going to run. So, Tom Nichols, I'm going to turn to you here. One of the other arguments that Diehl made this week is that just as Donald Trump may be pulling Republicans towards a Trump-based Republicanism, he thought that Democratic candidates in the Commonwealth would be pulled too progressive by the National Party, and there might not be appetite for that here. We have three Democratic candidates in the race right now: Danielle Allen, Ben Downing, Sonia Chang Diaz. Any merit in your mind to that argument? And should they run against Diehl, ignore Diehl, cheer Diehl on as he tries to primary a yet undeclared Charlie Baker?
Well, you know, this is, and of course, this is where I always have to remind people that I don't speak for the Navy or anybody else. This argument that the Democrats are going to be pulled to the far left is just inane, especially in the age of, you know, we keep forgetting the leader of the Democratic Party is Joe Biden, probably one of the most centrist Democrats of his time and of the past 40 years. And what the Republicans, there's two things the way the Republicans talk about this that I think people should be alert to. One is to say, yeah, sure, Biden's okay, but the Democratic Party is becoming, you know, socialists, and then all of the buzzwords come out, you know, race theory and all that other stuff. The other is to go back to what he said about what Diehl said about the election. You should really always be careful when they say, well, I accept that Joe Biden is the president, because what they really mean is, well, I know that that's how the process played out and I can't help it and I don't like it. It's a way of signaling to the real, you know, fanatical base. And unfortunately, blue state Republicans are sometimes even crazier than their red state counterparts, because they feel like a besieged minority. That's really a way of saying, no, I don't really accept this. You know, we can do Trumpism in New England. But I think the other thing to count on here is that Charlie Baker has avoided something that's happened in American politics, which is negative partisanship, which is people just voting against the other party. And I think any Republican who runs other than Baker is probably going, it will certainly run into the negative partisanship that, you know, the people in Massachusetts are just not going to accept a Republican governor that doesn't look like Charlie Baker or Phil Scott or, you know, Larry Hogan or that handful of Republicans.
So, So let's pick that up there, and let's use that as our way to pivot into the pandemic, because we talked with Anthony Brooks on air yesterday, WBUR's Anthony Brooks. He cited polling data from the data was late March. I think it was released on April 1st that showed that well over 60% of the state still feels like we're headed in the right direction. The pandemic is a big piece of any direction, Renee, that we're headed in right now. Things have gotten better objectively, but vaccine disparities exist. We had 99 new cases in the Commonwealth yesterday. The numbers are creeping up. We're at 0.46 7-day average of positivity, up from 0.42% reported Tuesday. Hospitalizations and deaths are thankfully low. So overall, the grade for Baker at this point on handling the pandemic in your mind?
I give him a solid C.
Only because
I think the rollout of the vaccines was so botched that it delayed things for a lot of people. I don't think that the effort was made to reach out to communities that were disproportionately affected early enough. You know, you had the whole point was to meet people where they were, and that wasn't done. Sending people down to Rentham or to Gillette was not going to cut it if you lived in Chelsea and didn't have a way to get there. So I think he blew that, frankly. Has it gotten better? Yes, it's gotten better. Massachusetts is one of the highest vaccination rates in the country. You know, our cases are still relatively low, though creeping up. But, you know, I'm going to remember the whole year of Charlie Baker and the pandemic, not just what's happened in the last few months.
All right. So, Tom, I appreciate Renee's comment. I am, for a minute here, going to focus on what's happened in the last couple months, though, and I'm really going to go for the last few weeks. So this week, the dean of Brown School of Public Health, Dr. Ashish Jha, talked to NPR about the Delta variant. Here he is.
The Delta variant is the most contagious variant of this virus we have seen throughout the entire pandemic. And there's some evidence that it's also more deadly if you are infected with it. It's significant because it does get a lot of people sick very quickly, and we need to get people vaccinated. And the fact that it has moved this fast means there are a lot of communities and a lot of people who are still quite vulnerable to this virus.
Now, we do, Tom, have high vaccination rates here in the Commonwealth and in the region, but this thing is for real. And it is quickly becoming, or will be predicted to be, the dominant strain where it isn't. Are you worried? Are you just watching? And do we have our infrastructure in place to deal with something new and malicious that's a spinoff of the old versions of this awful virus?
Well, I mean, I'm always worried until a pandemic is, you know, declared over and we can kind of plant a flag on top of it. But, you know, I'm in a relative sense, I'm not worried. And part of the reason I'm not worried is I follow Dr. Jha, who, hey, we've got him here in Rhode Island. You can't have him. You know, we recruited him away. So he's an ocean stater now. And, you know, if you follow Dr. John on Twitter, for example, he's a really steady source of calm and reasoned advice. And that advice always boils down to one thing, which is just go get vaccinated. You know, the Delta variant is very dangerous if you're not vaccinated. Yes, you can acquire it. It can be a breakthrough infection, but it will likely either be asymptomatic or mild. And, you know, it's almost becoming this kind of frustrated scream it from the rooftops of, you know, what are you waiting for to get vaccinated? Even though our vaccination rates in New England are high, it's not high enough. And I'm not sure what Charlie Baker or Dan McKee or Phil Scott or anybody else can do about that. At some point, people just have to kind of get off their butts and say, I'm going to go get a shot. They're giving them away in Rhode Island everywhere here.
So, Renee, I'm going to turn to you because we're going to go to hubbubs in a second. But before we do, and just briefly, you have been saying on our air for weeks, this pandemic isn't over. It's over for whom? So as the cases tick back up and we get this Delta variant, I'm wondering, have you been thinking sort of, welcome to the party, I saved you a seat?
No, I'm not gloating. I would have been thrilled to have been wrong about that. But when you're hearing things like 130 people died in Maryland last month and every single one of them was unvaccinated, you know, that's really upsetting. You know, there's something so frustrating about the fact that we, you know, it's like, I feel like the old, that old TV show, we have the technology to save people and people aren't doing it. We're stuck at about 48% vaccination rate right now in the country, and that's simply not going to cut it. And now we've got this variant going around that's so much more infectious and dangerous, not to mention that the longer the virus circulates, you give the opportunity for even more variants that could be even more deadly than the Delta variant. You know, I'm not even blaming Charlie Baker for that. I think everyone is trying to figure out a way to get people to get vaccinated, and it's just not working. They've tried incentives and it's just not doing it. The incentive should be to save your life and the lives of your loved ones. And if that's not enough to convince people, then I'm not really sure what is.
All right. We've got on the other side of this Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, but I do want to take a brief minute to do our hubbubs. Those local stories or events that caught our attention this week. Tom, what hubbub did you bring us?
Well, I was going to do an Ocean State hubbub about Massachusetts being green and Rhode Island still lagging behind, but I want to add a Boston hubbub with Renee doing an actual shout out to the $6 million man television show. So us kids of the 70s, Renee, thank you. That's my Boston hubbub, is go Steve Austin.
I just love when people get my arcane pop references. Thank you, Tom. I appreciate that.
All right, Renee, what about your hubbub?
This week marked the 238th anniversary of a landmark court ruling in Massachusetts. Quack Walker, who was an enslaved Black man, sued for his freedom, and after a series of trials, he won based on the premise that slavery was incompatible with the principles of liberty proclaimed in the new Massachusetts coalition. Slavery would continue to persist in Massachusetts for about another decade, but it was the beginning of the end of the so-called peculiar institution in Massachusetts. So we have Quack Walker to thank for that.
All right, excellent. So my hubbub is actually an invitation to listeners to give us feedback. I know we take calls all the time from folks who have lots of thoughts. We appreciate that. That's one way to hear from you, but we have another. It's important to us because we really care about what you want to hear on Radio Boston. So we have a Radio Boston survey online. It's about afternoon listening on WBUR. We'd love for you to take it and to tell us what you think. Please take it and be honest. What do you like? What can you do without? Tell us. So that site is wbur.org/survey. Again, that's wbur.org/survey. So, okay, I am going to lift the curtain here for a minute, everybody, including to you, Renee and Tom. We are anticipating Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. Oh, we have her. So I'm going to say goodbye to the two of you here. Renee Graham, a Boston Globe columnist and a WBUR contributor. Renee, thanks for today.
Thank you so much.
Tom Nichols, a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and a contributing writer at The Atlantic. Tom, thanks to you, too.
Thank you.
We are going to go into the weekend catching up with Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, who represents the 7th District. Congresswoman Pressley, thanks for taking the time. Welcome back to the show.
Always good to be with you.
So we're making this list today, Congresswoman, of the things that we could talk to you about, and it just kind of hit me what a week it has been. We have an armed standoff in Wakefield over the weekend, assassination of the Haitian president, where we have a huge Haitian community here in the area. We're in the middle of a tropical storm, although for us here at the station, I think it's kind of passed overhead. What a week. How have you been thinking about it? And how do you manage living as a congressperson in extraordinary times all the time?
Well, just, Yana, honestly, I mean, it has been this way since I was first elected. I think, unfortunately, in many ways, I've grown accustomed to the deluge of what is incoming. And if anything, despite the unprecedented challenges, I feel an even greater responsibility to be an effective steward at this moment. We're at an inflection point in so many ways, with the climate crisis, with the housing crisis, with the healthcare crisis, with the crisis when it comes to childcare. There are any number of things, but it all matters and it's all important. And so I just have to remain squarely focused on meeting the moment and moreover meeting the urgent and growing needs of the people that I represent in the Massachusetts 7th.
So let's talk about meeting that moment. You talked about some macro inflection points there, for example, housing, childcare. There is legislation back and forth on the table right now. Let's talk a little bit about infrastructure. We've been covering this debate within the Democratic Party over whether legislators should pass a standalone bipartisan infrastructure bill focused mainly on surface transportation, or to hold out and only pass that bill if there's movement on some larger spending that would address other Democratic priorities, like things you listed, climate change, support for children and families. First, updates. Are we seeing any progress on either of those in Congress? Do we have a bill coming that's going to get passed?
Well, we do expect Tiziana to see movement on these packages at some point this month. But what I continue to fight for are those bold investments in both physical and human infrastructure for our country. And that's what I've been banging the drum from, again, being responsive to the urgent needs of the people. Myself and many of my progressive colleagues have been championing that. And in fact, I serve on the House Financial Services Committee. One of the reasons why I ran for Congress was to fight for an expanded definition of infrastructure to go far beyond highways, roads, and bridges. How could housing not be included in the definition of infrastructure? So housing is infrastructure. Climate justice is infrastructure. We should not even have to make that argument. The world is making it for us at every moment, at every turn, when you see what is happening. And the care economy is infrastructure. This is an issue, child care, that I worked on during my tenure on the Boston City Council, and I've continued to work on now at the federal level. And, you know, senior and child care, the care economy, this is infrastructure, and we need to invest in it and act like that. Child care is as much about the GDP as it is about our families. And so these investments are really critical to our having a robust recovery. And I'm grateful that Speaker Pelosi and President Biden both committed to advancing a bold reconciliation package that is going to meet the scale and scope of these crises.
So I'm going to jump in there, and I'm just going to ask you sort of in a sentence then, should we anticipate that by the end of 2021, infrastructure will, in law, right, mean something bigger and different than it has been in the United States?
It certainly needs to. And I'm going to keep, you know, I stay at the table pushing and organizing for bigger and bolder investments that go as far and as deep as the hurt systemic in its nature is, especially given the unprecedented challenges of the last year. If we are truly going to have a just, equitable, robust recovery and rebuild a just nation that takes care of its people, we need universal child care. We need paid family leave. We need robust funding for something I led the fight for, and that's home and community-based services for the elderly and for folks with disabilities. Tiziana, I vice chair the Task Force on Aging and Families, and we had a briefing last week about the sandwich generation, of which I'm a member. Those are folks caring for an aging parent and also for a young child. And it was devastating, but not surprising to learn that 80% of those caregivers have had passive suicidal thoughts. The load is so heavy. So care is infrastructure, climate justice is infrastructure, housing is infrastructure, and we need to legislate and invest in it like it is.
So I'm going to move us to another heavy subject now with our remaining time, which is the death penalty. I know it's an issue you feel strongly about. I want to talk specifically about where you are with President Biden on the issue. So you're against the death penalty. You filed a bill in 2019 to abolish it. You seemed pretty encouraged by a recent statement from the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, that the DOJ will put a temporary stay on federal executions while the department reviews processes and procedures. You also seemed very frustrated and displeased by the DOJ's decision that it will continue to defend a death sentence for the Boston Marathon bomber at the Supreme Court, which was a process that was pursued by Barr in the previous administration. Where do you stand right now with the death penalty and Joe Biden's position on it? Are you pleased with him, displeased with him? Where are we?
Well, first, I just want to acknowledge that the action taken by the DOJ is welcome. It's long overdue. And they were heeding calls that myself and other advocates have been leading on for a long time. So they were responsive to those calls. And so it's a testament to the work of impacted families and generations of activists. I was at the White House recently. I spoke directly with the president while I was there. He gave me his word that no person in America would be executed by the federal government under his watch.
And do you believe that's the case, that over the next 4 years, we will not have a person executed by the federal government?
I certainly will continue to be vigilant in my efforts to ensure that the word that President Biden gave me, that is honored. The death penalty has no place in our society. State-sanctioned murder is not justice. And we're coming at this in three different ways. So the decisive action in the last Congress, we led this bill, myself and Senator Dick Durbin, to end the federal death penalty. I've been calling also on President Biden to use executive action to halt federal executions. And within that executive action, to commute the sentences of those on death row, to ensure fair resentencing processes, and to direct the DOJ prosecutors to no longer seek the death penalty, and, Tiziana, to dismantle the death row facility at Terre Haute. Passing our independent legislation, Senator Dick Durbin is my partner in that, who also chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee. So I think our chances look good, Tiziana. And we have over 90 co-sponsors of our bill. Close to 300 grassroots organizations have endorsed this. So momentum for this continues to grow. So at this point, this is about honoring the will of the people, but also protecting the people and what true justice really looks like. And that means abolishing the federal death penalty. We need to pass that independent bill to ensure that no future president can reinstate this, Tiziana, because under the Trump administration, when they resurrected that, they ostensibly went on a killing spree, executing more people in the final days of his administration than had been executed for the last six decades.
So that is all the time we have for now, Congresswoman. I do hope you will come back again soon. There's so much more for us to talk about. That's Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, who represents the 7th District. Will you come back and join us again soon, please?
Absolutely.
Thanks, and have a great weekend.
You too.